We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Ryan Dawson.
Fellow muckraker and friend of mine living in France, Michael McGee, will join us on the program today. He has 25 years of experience working with actual political refugees. I'm going to get his two cents on the refugee crisis in France, his thoughts on the elections there, and the influence of foreign country A. Hey, welcome back. It's been a while. How you been?
I'm doing fine. A lot of things have been happening over here in Europe. Yes, I'm in Strasbourg, which is right on the French-German border.
I didn't know Germany had a border.
Obviously, with all this massive immigration which has been happening in Europe, it's been going on for a while, but things have accelerated quite a bit. And obviously, everybody in the U.S., they saw the call by Merkel, the German chancellor, and François Hollande, the French president, calling for basically an open-door policy into Europe.
I like so those titles that you give the chancellor and the president, because I always call them NATO's regent in France, NATO's regent in Germany.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much the case, unfortunately. Huh? So there'd been some important developments in France. We had the regional elections in December of 2015, and that was a big scare for the ruling Socialist Party, because they've been having defeat after defeat after defeat politically. And so the French presidential elections are going to be coming up in 2017. And they're afraid they're going to lose the elections to the right-wing party called the UMP, and now they're called Les Républicains, the Republicans. And actually, the National Front, one of the right-wing groups, they had they're probably the most important group, which is campaigned against immigration in France, and they had they actually became the most important political party in France, not only during the last regional elections, but before that in the European elections also. They were actually the first party numerically in France, even if in France you have usually a two-tiered electoral system. You have the first round, and the National Front was the majority party in the first round, but then you go into the second round and you have different alliances. So I would imagine that the socialists, they represent anywhere between 15% and 20%. The UMP Republican Party, they probably represent around 30%. And the National Front, it was against the massive immigration, they probably represent now around 35%. And then you've got other groups like some of the left-wing groups, which is called Le Front de Gauche, the Left Front. They probably represent anywhere between 5% and 10%, and the Green Party is probably around anywhere from 3% to 7%, something like that, depending on the election.
Well, let's be clear. When you say immigration, you don't mean regular immigration and assimilation. You're talking about the refugee crisis, right?
Well, obviously, France has a long colonial history, so there are a number of immigrants which have come here and have been here for years from northern Africa. Algeria was a colony, Morocco, Tunisia, but now that you're looking at the colonial history, the end of the Algerian War was in 1961-62, so that's been a while. And all of these countries have been formally independent for many years. So, but there still is that going back and forth between these countries, and a lot of France has a policy where they're supposed to accept political refugees. And so a lot of people don't really know what a political refugee is, and that's used to kind of confuse people, because I give my shirt for a real political refugee. And like we were saying earlier when we spoke, I've been working with real political refugees for the last over a quarter of a century. And since I'm Irish, I've worked with the Sinn Féin when they had their the peace process was going on for the Good Friday Agreement. I've worked with, there's an important Kurdish population in Strasbourg also, and that's where I got my first experience doing lobbying in the European institutions because the Kurds needed somebody that could actually speak not only French, but English. So I was their English expert, and they gave me my first pair of parliamentary pants because they told me you can't go into the European Parliament looking like that. So they gave me this flashy pair of dressed up pants, and that's where I started to learn how to lobby. And that was, like I say, over a quarter of a century ago. So I've worked with refugees, we had almost the whole Chechen government in exile during the first Chechen-Russian war, which was here in Strasbourg. So we worked closely together. They've been with American Indians, with Palestinians, with people from Rwanda, you name it, they come to Strasbourg because Strasbourg is one of the major capitals in Europe for anything touching on international affairs. So that would be Brussels, Strasbourg, where we have European Parliament meets, and also Geneva, obviously, where you have the United Nations. So those are the three key cities in Europe today for anything having to do with international affairs.
Well, I like having that groundwork set because you've been working with legitimate political refugees from all over the world. And what's happening now, what I see, the kind of circus TV media, not what's going on the ground, but what we see from mass media is there's a flood of Syrian refugees. They're always named and labeled Syrian, even though the majority of them are not from Syria and are not fleeing a war. And the only possible reason anybody could ever oppose this refugee crisis and floods of immigrants is because they're xenophobic and racist or Islamophobic, and there's no other possible economic or political reason to oppose these policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's the rhetoric. No,
I was giving the example of a friend's hotel where this is a two-star hotel in Strasbourg, just near the train station, and this has been going on for a couple of years, but almost half of the clients in the hotel, either anywhere from half to three quarters, they're actually people that are housed there by the town or the regional government as people that are asking for political refugee status. And like I said, I know what a political refugee is. I can talk with somebody and I'll let you know in less than 15 minutes if he's a political refugee or not. And none of these people, with some rare exceptions, almost none of them are real political refugees. And a political refugee is somebody that's taken personal risks to himself, to his family, to defend the general interest, to defend his country. And most of the people that are coming in, they could care less about what's happening in France, obviously, but they could care less about what's happening in their country. They're coming to Europe in order to improve their financial status. And these are not part of the poorest population that's in these countries, whether it be from Syria or whatever country in Europe or Africa. These are people that have the money to pay what we call in French les passeurs. These are these mafia networks that make a lot of money in bringing people through in boats or in clandestine cars, things like that. That usually it takes most individuals that are coming to Europe anywhere between 10 and 20,000 euros, that's more than $20,000, to come to Europe. And most of the impoverished populations throughout the world, they don't have that kind of money, which means that most of the people that are coming in are from middle class or relatively well-to-do populations in their respective countries. But they can make even more money if they come, for example, like I was saying, to France. You have the hotel that costs 2,000 euros, and that's paid for by the taxpayer. And then people are getting 700 euros in financial aid per month. That's 700 euros in spending money because everything else is taken care of. The housing is taken care of. They don't have to pay any electricity or gas. They basically get a lot of help with food. They have absolutely free medical expenses. And like I say, for an American, you know the situation of health care for a lot of Americans. Boy, I know a lot of Americans which would love
what
these
is
political refugees in France.
Healthcare?
Yeah,
what's
yeah.
that?
Exactly. So this is something which is costing the French taxpayer at least, and this is a minimum, at least 3,000 euros, over $3,000 a month. And this can go on for anywhere from 2 to 6 years because someone who asks for political refugee status, even if he gets turned away after 2 years, he can make an appeal, ask for it again, and make a second appeal. So like I said, there are people in the hotel that have been there for almost 6 years now. So that's a lot of money, and the financial and economic situation in France, like in most countries in the world, there's a political crisis, there's an economic crisis going on. And a lot of people among the French who are in unemployment or who are asking for housing, and they see somebody that comes in from another country and right away gets the aid that they aren't capable of getting now. So that's created a lot of conflict with a lot of normal people in France, because they figure, well, why are we paying for all of this? We can't take on the misery of the world.
Which also really hurts. It really hurts the legit political refugees too, because they're going to get grouped in with all these leeches. You know, maybe this is a joke, but maybe I should flee to France and get a free vacation in a hotel for a couple months so I can interview a lot of these people and get some media on there, and the French government will pay for the whole thing.
Exactly. I can get you a cheap Syrian passport if you want, Ryan. Huh?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. I'd always wanted to go to France, and now that I can get in a hotel for free and have them actually pay me to be there, that'd be pretty cool. Now, babe, that's a problem with socialism, though. I mean, it turns out when you pay people not to work, that's exactly what they do.
Well, whether it be the Socialist Party in France or the right-wing, supposedly conservatives, it's pretty much the same thing. And it's a little bit like what's going on in the U.S. is that a lot of
Europe does not have a right wing. Europe has two left wings.
Pardon?
And Europe has left and more left. There is no right wing in Europe. Europe.
I kind of compare it to the situation between the Democrats and the Republicans. A lot of voters don't see any enormous political differences, even if there are some. It's the same thing between the socialists and the conservatives in most of the European countries also.
It won't matter. And so are most people aware of what's going on, like at least in Europe? Because what they see in the Americas is just floods of refugees, and Europe is so kind and taking them all in and no problem.
Well, there's a big disconnect between what the political and media elite say on the mainstream media and what most normal people, when you talk with people out in the street, have to say. And people are, they feel powerless, I guess I'd say, and that whatever they think or whatever they say, the politicians aren't going to respect that. So there's kind of this sentiment of, we can't do much. Huh? And so there's also been a big swing to vote for the National Front Party, which has opposed immigration for a long time. So that's one of the main reasons, I think, that they've become the first party numerically in France today, because of the question of massive immigration.
Now, well, they have like a double-layered election, though. So they were first in the round one portion, but round two, when they start building alliances, what do you have a guess how much it would drop off?
Yeah, well, the last regional elections in December, in the first rounds, the National Front was anywhere between 35% and 40%, and that scared the hell out of the Socialist Party. And so they started negotiating. They put together what they called a Republican Front with the right wing Republican Party
We call them cuck-servatives. they pretend right.
Yeah. Well, and so they put together this Republican Front. And in the second round, the National Front didn't win in any of the regions because, like I say, they represent between 35 to 40%. The socialists are around 15 to 20%. And the UMP Republican Conservative Party, they're between, I would say around 30%, something like that. Huh? And then the Front de Gauche, the left front, which is with the Communist Party and some of the far left, they probably represent around, I'd say 8 to 10%, even if they've fallen quite a bit because of the flip-flop of the Syriza Party in Greece, where and I saw some of the interviews some of the discussions you'd had on that, and that was a big blow to the European left, because most of the Greek population, when they had the referendum, voted massively against the austerity measures that was being imposed by not only the German government but by the European Union. And then the Syriza government turned around a couple of days after that and actually put in worse measures than what was proposed by the European Union. So basically what that said to a lot of people was that there was no alternative to the austerity measures imposed by the European Union. So that, like I said, there's been less and less influence of the communist parties and the left wing, but they still exist politically. And then there's the Green Party, which is probably anywhere between 3% and 7%. And when you're in periods of economic crisis like everybody's experiencing in Europe, usually the ecologist parties are more or less considered as a luxury. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, at least it's not winner take all voting like America.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a lot easier to.
Our dictatorship's worse than yours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the situation with this massive immigration open door policy. And I think what's going to happen in the future is that what are called the populist parties, like the Nationalist Front, they're going to have more and more political weight. And people, like most people, don't accept that. And you can see it when you go to any large city in Strasbourg, in Paris. You get out of the train station in what they call the East train station, the Gare de l'Est. You go into the neighborhoods, and you don't feel like you're in France. You think you might be someplace in Africa, and that's it's becoming more and more visible. And obviously the political elites, they're very generous with the taxpayers' money, but they're not the ones that have to deal with the problems that are generated by this massive immigration. And that's why most of the populist parties are getting good political scores, because the people in the poorer neighborhoods, in the working class neighborhoods, they're the ones that have to deal with this. And obviously that creates a lot of problems of there's a lot of drug dealing and a lot of different types of underground activities, I guess I'd say.
Well, I would imagine there's a lot of drug dealing, considering it's organized crime that's benefiting the most from rafting these people back and forth.
Oh yeah, this
I
is
mean,
a,
the same people. The same
a,
people that have the
multi-billion-dollar industry.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's an overlapping industry with organized crime. That's the same narco traffickers are the very same ones engaged in the other. Complex criminal activities, which is going to include bringing in refugees, faking passports, things like that. What I don't get is, what benefit is there to the government to waste all this tax money on leeches? Like, why is just ideological problem, or is there some sort of monetary benefit to themselves to bring in hordes of tax leeches?
Well, I was talking about the Socialist Party specifically. They have lost a lot of the populist support that they used to have in the working class. And so they figure, well, if the working class, which is now voting for the populist National Front Party, they figure if they bring in all of these people from other countries and they give them the possibility to vote, that will replace their voter base that they don't have anymore. So that's one of the reasons for the Socialist Party.
Votes you can buy.
Yep, exactly. And another reason, it's the impact of the pro-Israel lobby in France. And that's very influential, whether it be in the Socialist Party or in the UMP Republican Party, the conservatives. The Israel lobby has an enormous influence. And it's comparable to what you see in APAC in the U.S., the Les CRIF, the Consistoire. This is the representative of France. They have a yearly almost all on the door for this dinner, so that they can the representative.
Your sound's going in and out, but I know how it is when, you know, whoever shows up to their dinners is who ends up getting elected. And I want to talk to you more about that after you get some battery charged a little bit more. Do you know about the anti-APAC conference coming in March this year? Because I'd love to see you there.
It's in D.C. I haven't heard anything about
it. It's going to be in Washington, D.C. I'm coming all the way from Japan, so you could make it from France. Grant Smith and all these prominent speakers, pro-Palestinian speakers, are going to be there. But it's about gutting these Israeli lobbies out of the U.S. because that's really the worst.
Do you know what? Do you have the exact dates of that conference, Ryan?
Yeah, it's at the Washington Press Club, and it's March 18th, the day after St. Patrick's Day, and I know you know when that is.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Let's talk about it.
I was thinking of going back to the U.S., so I'll try and work that out so I can be there on the 18th. Then.
Well, I'm going to be there, and a lot of prominent speakers, people you know, are going to be there, so it would be really great, actually.
Okay.
You can't get sure, a free. The government's and not going to pay for your hotel or anything, but.
Oh, dear. Well, if you could send me out a link on that, I would be extremely interested by that, and we'll see if we can work something out there.
Yeah, I'll send it to you, and then there's a website, israelsinfluence.org, that has all this information about it. We're still lining up speakers. We have some of the keynote speakers in the IRMAP and Grant Smith. He's organized a lot of this. I know Jeff Blankford's going to be there. Uh-huh. Scott Ricard's going to be there. People have been on this show, right?
Uh-huh.
Wow. We'll all be there.
Well, that'll be extremely interesting. Huh? So I'll do what I can to come over. Huh?
Yeah. Keep that March 18th date open because I'm trying to get a lot of prominent thinkers there, and we want to get a lot of media attention to this. So it would be lovely if you could come. And I'll have some information about hotels too, because I think I'd be able to secure something for a lot of us, like international travelers. So,
okay, great, huh? Great. Well, so that obviously the Israel lobby is extremely influential in France, in a similar way that they are in the U.S. And that's been a lot of the impetus behind not only the never-ending wars of aggression, whether it be against Libya, whether it be against Syria, Iran, Lebanon. You name it. And obviously this open door policy has been being promoted also by the Israel lobby.
Yeah, but they don't have one for their own country.
No.
They have a seek and destroy, sure, bulldoze the house and move the border further east. You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. It's something
it's
else. I mean, that's why we're there. That's why we went to Iraq, too. I mean, they literally had a cabal inside the Pentagon, the Office of Special Plans, all of them dual citizens with Israel. That cooked up and manufactured all these lies to send the U.S. to war in Iraq. It's without the Iraq war, you couldn't have had Libya. Definitely couldn't have had Syria. So it is the central issue. And I can't stress enough. People talk about all kinds of things, but I'm like, look, the Israeli lobby, that's what we got to combat right there. And the BDS movement's working. I do want to talk to you about the boycott movement in France, too, because they started labeling products. And then they got attacked by terrorist mercenaries all of a sudden. But let's take a break and charge the batteries a little bit, and we'll come back on those topics. How's that sound?
Okay, very good. I'll give you a call in about 15 minutes then, huh?
Okay.
Hello?
And we are back.
Okay,
after this short break, which will be instantaneous in the recording.
Okay.
We were talking about the anti-APAC conference, but I'll send you all the information on that. Are you aware of how the French made it illegal to organize boycotts against Israel, and immediately afterward they had a terrorist attack? How can you make boycotting illegal? I mean, people have the right to buy or not buy whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Well, obviously the pro-Israel lobby is very influential there also. And I'm sure you're aware that several countries in Europe, including France and Germany, it's even illegal to discuss different questions about the Second World War, huh?
Yeah, you can go to jail. I've interviewed people who went to jail for that. Germar Rudolph was a chemist that went to Auschwitz and tested the walls and things and came back with the answers they didn't want, and they put him in jail because he couldn't find what they asked him to. Unreal.
I think we're in a situation now that all this information is circulating through internet, and it used to be that either the information was unavailable or you didn't have access to the mainstream media. Now more and more people, their own media. You're a good example of that, huh?
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's going like that. I don't know how much influence I've had, but maybe on 9/11 I had some impact. But I do get all the black sheep. I will have on the historical revisionists and things from the Civil War, World War II, whatever. And they're very taboo subjects. Mm. It's the same thing. Questioning any aspect about, say, Lincoln or Germany or Japan or whatever, and what were the losers in World War II, or the South, the Civil War. If you do that, there's always this stigma of what are you, racist? Are you a Nazi? Are you whatever? And it's kind of like the refugee crisis. If you oppose this flood of free lunch refugees, not the real political refugees, that the only reason you could possibly have that stance is because you're prejudiced, which is ridiculous. But that's leftist politics. They are hypersensitive to biological categories, as Gilad Osman says, these race, sex, gender issues, and religion.
You're making another point there about the refugees that I forgot. Since
a huge drain from, look at all the resources going to the free lunch refugees that should be going to the political refugees. And it's kind of like, I had a friend just make this example. It's sort of like the new wave feminists and all their rape allegations. Stop eyeball raping. Mm-hmm. You're delegitimizing actual rape victims, one of the most horrible things. And you're making it seem like, oh, was it rape or feminist rape? You know, it's kind of like I can make a bunch.
You made the good point, the excellent point that it's actually delegitimizing real political refugees, because in the larger population, people figure, well, if all these people are coming in, we don't want to have anything to do with the political refugees at all. So the fact of confusing an economic quote unquote refugee with a political refugee has the impact of making it much more difficult for the real political refugees to get refugee status. So.
Yeah, the U.S. had the same problem in the 80s with people from Nicaragua and Guatemala. Like during Iran-Contra, people were trying to flee. And, of course, anybody south of the border is just a Mexican looking for a job. And it just wasn't the case. They were fleeing the U.S.'s own covert mercenaries, the Contras, just like ISIS in Syria. They're the Contras 2.0.
We're going all in all sorts of different directions here, but you were mentioning also all these false feminists. The Femin group over here has really wreaked havoc, and unfortunately it's had a lot of influence on whether it be the left and the right, because people thought that they were very courageous. But I think there's been a lot of string pulling and manipulation using this Femin group, and a lot of that has been directed also against Russia and Vladimir Putin.
So it's that's the real motive. This is how the left works. It's always cloaked into some do-gooder sounding veneer where, oh, it's we're killing Gaddafi for humanitarian reasons. We're preemptively stopping a crisis where we think he was about to maybe kill a town or something. It's always colored with fighting sexism or fighting racism. We're going to Iraq to liberate the Kurds, which was a total farce. We went to Afghanistan for women's rights. It's always got to have this veneer of some socially acceptable pretext. But the reality is, it's always about money and energy and Israelis, and, you know, and that's the truth of the matter. But you never get at that. The right wing is more honest. They're like, yeah, we're going to go bomb and take their stuff. But the left always colors it in deception, which makes them worse, I think.
Yeah. It's more hypocritical. I think those are the three major taboo points that need to be dealt with in American politics, One has to do with all of these never-ending, costly humanitarian, supposedly humanitarian interventionist wars. And that's the modern-day pretext to go to war anywhere anymore. It has to be for quote-unquote humanitarian reasons. The second has to do with the role, the important domineering role of the Israel lobby in American politics, and that's still a very taboo subject among the left.
That's the driving force. I mean, that totally dictates U.S. foreign policy. It is absolutely why there was a second war in Iraq, and that is what is spilled over into everything else. And they can't admit that. They're like, it's over oil. Like, really? They already had the oil for food program between the two wars, and the euro didn't even exist when the propaganda started for the war. So it wasn't this petrodollar stuff. Not for that. That was completely by the Israeli lobby. They set up an office within an office, the Office of Special Plans, and cherry-picked all this information. The actual intelligence analyst didn't even know it existed until just a couple months before the war started. They didn't even know what Fife and Pearl and those guys were doing. But then after the fact, even the media won't even report on it. And again, it's the same thing because of this leftist taboo where, you know, you have a bunch of racist Jews, Zionists, that's what Zionists are, racist Jews, who have these policies for their, you know, racial agenda where they have a racial apartheid and colonize their neighbors. I mean, that is the reality of the situation. But to call them out on that is to get yourself labeled racist, because in leftist political thinking, only whites can be racist. And of course, whites can be racist, but it is at least a social stigma when whites behave that way. But when any other group does it, they'll support it because they're scared to death of getting labeled racist themselves. And I think it's because a lot of them harbor closet racism themselves. They have this paternalistic view where they have to help all these lesser minorities. It's just disgusting. It's a real slap in the face. And the social programs that the left have supported, like welfare, and it's subsidizing failure. It is hurting minorities. It is hurting refugees. It's hurting all the people they say they're trying to help. And they've got both fingers in their ears and their mouth going 100 miles an hour. Then they're so emotionally wrapped around race and sex issues that they cannot come to terms with the economic realities on the ground or any nuanced position. It's just, I have to be on the left because everything else is racist, xenophobic. It's just some kind of prejudice that is the absolute fuel for their entire ideology. But I wanted to ask you about the boycott situation in France. Was there any reaction there on the ground as to what? How can you tell us what we're allowed to buy or not buy? And to follow up on that, I think they found a clever way around that by saying, well, okay, we won't boycott them, but we're going to label products from the West Bank, which effectively is a boycott because nobody would buy anything from such a situation.
Oh,
hi.
Another?
Yeah, your sound's coming in clear. I just kept going on my rant because you weren't able to intercede because I couldn't hear you. So I was like, I'll just keep bashing the left. I could do this all day. But yeah, I wanted your thoughts on that and the boycott situation.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the people that have participated in those boycotts have come from the left, whether it be people on the left front close to Syriza, on the Green Party. Some of these people are being attacked, some of the people in the Communist Party. But what I was saying after your rants, what's even worse today, politically speaking, than racism is anti-Semitism. And it's interesting because most people don't really know what Semitism is. And a lot of the peoples from the Middle East are Semitic peoples that speak, whether they speak Arabic or whether there was Akkadian, Phoenician, Aramaic, the language that Jesus used. All of these languages are Semitic languages, and obviously Hebrew was one of those Semitic languages. But most of today's people that are Jewish aren't necessarily Semitic Jews. There are a lot of, obviously, the Ashkenazi Jews that are white European Jews. Their native language was Yiddish, which is interesting because Yiddish is a German dialect which is very close to Alsatian, that is, it's spoken here in the region where I live. So anybody who speaks Alsatian can easily understand someone who speaks Yiddish. So this idea of the Zionist lobby has almost hijacked even the term Semitic. And when you repeat it endlessly, it becomes part of the public discourse, which means that people aren't even aware of what real anti-Semitism is.
In other words, it's just become anti-Jewish. And actually, it's worse than that. It's become anything that's against Israel, the nation. It's not even about ethnicity or religion anymore. If you don't agree with what Israel is doing, it's because you hate Jews. That's how immature and just conflated it's become. Oh, the only reason you could not support, burning babies alive or bulldozing houses and or building a wall across your border and annexing territories because you hate Jews. And it's so basic, but that is the real
one of the main organizations in the pro-Israel lobby here in France is called the LICRA, La Ligue Internationale contre le Racisme et l'Antisémitisme. So this is the International League Against Racism and Anti-Semitism. And obviously it's the people in the pro-Israel lobby that pull the strings behind that. But it's interesting that they separated racism from quote-unquote anti-Semitism. And that's obviously politically, it's political suicide. Anybody that is too critical of Israel is labeled anti-Semitic. And recently we had an interesting phenomena with one of probably the best comics in France today. He's a guy who's half Dieudonné, exactly. He's half, his father was from Cameroon and his mother was from Brittany. And he's obviously, when you look at him physically, he looks African. And so he did a few sketches. He's certainly the best comic in the whole of France. And he did a sketch back in, I believe it was, trying to think, it's been a while back now. I wonder if it was 2003 or, well, anyway, it was a sketch on some of the Israeli settlers. And it only lasted. Exactly. Well, it only lasted for 5 minutes. And after that 5 minute sketch, he was lambasted by the Israel lobby, and it's rather rare. He's not only is he very intelligent, but he's very courageous, because most of the comedians in France, if they would have been attacked about that, they would have come groveling back and saying, I'm sorry, I'll never do it again. And people get into line on that question, because everyone knows that whether it be professionally or even everyday things that happen in your life, if you're attacked by the Israel lobby, you can have a lot of problems. And Dieudonné was instrumental.
I know how it is to be attacked by the lobby. I've had the SPLC after me, the ADL after me. I've had people write nasty things about me online. And, when I go to employers or even trying to get a guest for my shows, they'll Google me up and they'll read what Adam Holland wrote, all that trash. And they paint me like some anti-Semitic lunatic or something, which is nuts. But that's, you criticize Israel and that's the camp you're placed in. Oh, you must hate Jews. And the ironic thing is the people fighting actual racism and apartheid are labeled racist. And the people supporting that are actually causing real anti-Semitism or hatred toward Jews because of their behavior.
There we go. Is a little better?
There we go. Yeah, it's going to be an editing nightmare, but okay. It's fine.
Yeah, well, I'm out in the middle of nowhere. I'm up in the Vosges Mountains about 35 minutes from Strasbourg, so maybe that's one of the reasons that the internet connection isn't extraordinary, yeah?
It could be. We could have had an earthquake or something, too. That tends to happen around here. But yeah. I don't know. I'm in the mountains, too, in Nara. But it's not really the middle of nowhere because it's Japan and there is no middle of nowhere. They're packed and it's, I don't know, it's very high tech society. Uh-huh. I've never lost a cell phone signal.
I was mentioning that one of the interesting Moroccan French authors over here, who's Jewish, he was born in Meknes in Morocco. His name is Yacoub Cohen, and he wrote a very interesting novel, must have been about 5 years ago, called Le Printemps de Sayanim. That means the springtime of the Sayanim. And you probably know that the Sayanim, these are the Mossad in a lot of the Western country.
Yeah, it's diaspora with fanatic loyalties to Israel.
Exactly. And so this was a denunciation of the role that played the
your sound's going out again.
Is that better?
Yeah, we'll keep trying. We'll try this, and if it if it continues to poot out, we'll just connect at another time. So but continue on about that, this, Mr. Cohen.
Yeah, so Yacoub Cohen, he was actually physically beat up by the Jewish Defense League, a Zionist militia here in France. It's actually forbidden in the U.S. and in Israel. So he was physically beat up, and they actually filmed the attack against him by these young guys. And he's in his early 70s. So this was very courageous of the Zionist militia to beat him up, and they actually put it on YouTube, and nothing happened. He was Yacoub Cohen went to the judicial authorities, and nothing happened. So that gives you an idea sometimes of the impunity of people in the Israel lobby that think that they're above the laws, not only internationally, but here in France, there are a lot of good examples of that. Huh? So, and I think it's becoming more and more visible to a lot of people. And even if it's still, I don't think it's a taboo subject that it used to be. And Dieudonné, the comic, he had an important role in bringing that out into the open and having it be discussed among thousands and even millions of people. And every time Dieudonné does a sketch or goes, he has an interview on YouTube, there are literally millions of people that go onto that YouTube sketch. Huh?
People were calling the canal a Nazi salute. That's how desperate they got. And comics are very effective with the left because comics deal with politics usually in the realm of ridicule, which appeals to the sort of snarky, arrogant ideology that leftists have, this sort of air of superiority where they have to have this paternal racism and stuff. They're very powerful, and so Dieudonné was able to reach people who would otherwise not listen to a journalist or read an author or something, but they will watch a comic. And so comedians are able to reach leftists. Whereas these people aren't really reading books on economics and things before they wouldn't be leftists. So they're able to hear the message if you package it in jokes and ridicule, because that's what all they ever listen to. Yeah. So he's very powerful.
Actually, that actually coalesced politically, and that's maybe one of the specificities here in France. You have there's an organization over here called Égalité et Réconciliation, which was actually uniting of forces between a lot of people that used to beat one another up, whether it be on the far left or the far right. And so that they were actually very close to Dieudonné, and they had a general assembly, I think it was in last November. And then they created a political organization, but it takes a while for political organizations to actually really develop. So I don't think they'll really have any impact in politics formally for a while. But Dieudonné was extremely important in making that, bringing it out of the margins, I guess I'd say. Huh?
I'll tell you a funny Dieudonné story. When he was being really popular after he came up with the canal, which is very powerful because it's a physical symbol against apartheid.
Yep.
Gilad Osman was visiting Japan, and so we took him out to dinner and maybe drinking a little bit, but we were going around and everybody got on the Dantotori Bridge and did the canal for a picture, and a lot of Japanese people just joined in because that's how friendly they are, and they were all doing the canal too and didn't even know what it was, but we got these huge photos of all these people. And so we were just going around Osaka and we'd say no, like sort of like 1, 2, 3, and everyone would go Dieudonné, and then they'd flash the canal. Fun times.
you'll have to send me out some of those photos. I'm sure did you send any to Dieudonné?
I don't have a contact with him, but I'd love to get him the photos.
Well,
Gilad has them.
okay.
Maybe he
You,
sent them.
if you send me out some of those photos, I'll make sure that they get to Dieudonné also, huh?
Yeah, that would be good. I'd like to interview him, but I'm skeptical of my French because it's been about 8 years. Because I don't ever need French in Japan. So.
Yeah, well, I'll see if he can I'm not sure how well he manages English. I'm sure he does a little bit, but if not, I could even give a helping hand if that would be useful, huh?
That would be cool. I'd love to talk to him. And I'll dig up
Okay.
those photos for you. It was fun times.
Okay, well, like I say, send those out and I'll that'll be a good means to make him be interested in that interview because I'm sure he probably doesn't know a lot of militants or activists from the US. So if I send him out those photos, I'm sure that will interest him, huh? So.
Yeah, we had another Irish journalist with us that night too, Michael Kyle, I call him. He broke this story on McCain going and meeting with Al Nusra Front. That was he's back in Ireland now, but yeah, we were all out there, and there's well, they have to be anonymous, but some other people. But fun times. Gilad went to an Irish bar, and they gave him a shot glass with a Star of David on it. He got a big kick out of that. It was just random, you know. They only had one, and it ended up going to Gilad, right? Well, it was perfect.
Well, he's in England most of the time. I mean, he's quite a character too, Gilad.
But he is. He's very controversial, and like I said, I get all the black sheep. The story you just told me about Cohen reminded me of David Cole or David Stein. He got beat up by a Jewish Defense Force while he's just walking
Really?
home from the he's going to his mom's house from the grocery store, and they ganged him. He's a little guy, you know, and these guys just jumped him while he's holding groceries and broke his nose, knocked him out. And he went into hiding after that, and nothing happened to them. They eventually got arrested for trying to blow up a mosque. However, the mosque they were blowing up was actually quite pro-Israel. They're very Zionist, and so that finally, when they attacked another Zionist because they thought they were evil Muslims, they went to jail, and Herb Rubin died in jail. He got thrown off a roof. Good riddance. But yeah, there are some fanatics that just are willing to use physical force to intimidate comics or writers or historians. They'll go right after them. But yeah, David's been on the program many times, and Gilad's been on the program a few times too. I always like it when he comes to Japan because a prominent Zionist tends to die, coincidentally. Boris Berezovsky died the first year, and then Ariel Sharon died next. So I said, man, you need to just go back and forth to Japan and see if this magic will keep working. Maybe we can get rid of Kissinger, Richard Pearl, and just go down the list. That would be quite awesome. I would like to do, when we have better connections sometime, a whole segment on intimidation tactics, physical or economic, because you can lose your job, like Norman Finkelstein and others have been, you know, pushed out of academia because of their stances on Israel. Comics, writers, etc. That would be, I'd love to talk to you about that and get and hear about the situations in France too, when we got a better connection. But I think I'll get your thoughts on what we were just saying, and then I think we're going to close it out because it keeps the connection keeps dropping, and so it'd be easier just to do it later. But do you have any final thoughts on you know, what happened to Cole or Gilad, or did you want to continue a little bit more about Dieudonné while we have sound?
Well, I was thinking that also, obviously, one of I was mentioning three elements that were important for politics in America to reorient things in the right direction. The first I mentioned was stopping all of these costly, never-ending interventionist, supposedly humanitarian wars. And the second was the confronting the role of the Israel lobby in American politics. That's extremely important to have people organized, and that's why people like Jeffrey Blankford are key in that, because there are people, they're not they're usually individuals, and as long as people are simply individuals, it's easier to attack them. once people start being organized, and I think we need to give some visibility to the real anti-Zionist Jewish activists also, so it's a collective movement and not simply some supposedly self-hating Jews. That's an important aspect. And the third aspect, and you've played an important role in that, is revisiting what happened in 9/11, because that was a seminal event that basically oriented what's happening in the 21st century. And I think obviously more and more people are starting to question the official narrative of 9/11, but it's still not clear for a lot of people who are the people actually pulling the strings behind that.
Right.
And obviously you've got a lot of crazies in the 9/11 movement. That's probably because you've got a lot of crazies
in the
world. I
did an interview a couple days ago that's not out yet, but the guy that was interviewing me came up with a nice term. He said, there's the official story, and then there's like the official conspiracy story too. And they're both dogmatic.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you have my research from Empire Unmasked, War by Deception, which it doesn't need any speculation. I've laid it out with all the documents from the FBI's own reports of the people filming the first plane hitting and so on. But that information has to get out there. And so that distribution is huge. Stopping the imperial escapades is huge, and stopping AIPAC is huge. But really, if you stop AIPAC, then you win all three, because we wouldn't have imperial escapades without the lobby. And without the lobby's resistance, I'm pretty sure we could get the information to 9/11 out too. Of course, if you got that one out, that would also kill the lobby and the intervention. So either one of those, those are the most important, which is why that's what I'm focusing on. And I really hope you'll be there in March. That would be great.
Well, I'm going to do everything I can to be out there, and I'll see if I can get some other interesting people to come also. So I think my last thoughts on this is that it's extremely important for people to be informed and not just be sheep out there looking at American Idol, but to see what's happening in their everyday political lives and be the media like you've been doing a very good job at. So people need to be informed, and they also need to be organized, because if you're not politically organized, you basically get screwed.
If you're atomized, you're not going to get anywhere. Yeah, if you're just atomized individuals, you won't get as far as organized. It's okay to have a leader when you agree with them. It's not like you're just following. You happen to agree, and so you organize. Also, you have to not be afraid. There's a lot of anonymous people who understand everything that's going on, but they're like, meh. And, if enough people stand up, it won't be as bad. The first few people to stand up get hammered. I've taken a hammering. I'll do that. But, eventually other people got to come along and voice it. It's the problem is with, like, 9/11, people aren't as afraid of the government as they are. They're afraid of voicing their opinion on 9/11 because they don't want to get that stigma from Alex Jones where they look like a lunatic. That's the real damage. That's what's preventing people from speaking out on 9/11, is they don't want to sound like a crazy person. Lot more people spoke out against, say, the Iraq War, even though the government was totally pro-Iraq War. Plenty of people spoke out against the war and said there aren't any weapons of mass destruction, blah, 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 blah. But you don't have that number for 9/11 because of the stigma that has been created by like Loose Change and Alex Jones and Fetzer and all these lunatics. And you notice the media gives them a fat microphone, and they avoid researchers like myself or maybe Schumann or, you know, other, like, what I consider factual journalists that actually use documentation instead of scare tactics. So I think the key thing's going to be this March. Like, if we get enough media attention, see, last year C-SPAN was supposed to cover it and pulled out at the last second. And so I covered it. But I only had like 10 minutes notice. So Mike Rivera put it on and I got social media and all. But we could have done a lot better. And we will this year because we're
Okay. Well, that'll be an important political event then. Do you know if Stefan Sniegorski will be there also?
I have a list somewhere. I don't know, to be honest. But a lot of good ones are there. And I'm inviting people. If not as speakers, I think Jeff Blankford's speaking, actually. He spoke last year. He's going to be on the program Monday, so I'll ask him about it. He just mentioned him, so he'll be on. He's another anti-Zionist Jew. Grant Smith will be there for sure. I know Scott Ricard is going. I don't know if he's speaking, but he's going to be going. He said he's attending. So in the past, you can look up some of the guests. We'll have a lot of the BDS movement, some of the college kids, and we'll also have a lot of prominent speakers, Fisk and guys, you know, Palestinian rights activists.
That'll be a Friday, if I'm not mistaken.
I think
Friday,
so.
Friday, March 18th?
Yeah, day after St. Patrick's Day, so.
Yeah, so that'll be, then they'll have the following weekend, which will be interesting to have discussions with people also, huh?
Yeah, I was hoping it wouldn't be a weekend so that I could go lobby in D.C. the next day, but what I may do instead is try and do some lobbying Wednesday and Thursday, go to the APAC, anti-APAC event on Friday, and then Saturday just play with my friends. What I mean, nerd play, like have talked to all the cool people who came. But we'll see. I mean, I'm hoping to get a lot of connections with the people there. I'll put out business cards and get a lot of guests for the show too, and get every single speech recorded and up on the proper channels and disseminated as much as possible.
Well, very good, huh?
I think so.
Okay, well, I'm glad I called you to get that information, huh? So
Well, it would have come out anyway, but yeah, I hope you're there, because like I said, we're gonna try and organize. I'm gonna do a fundraising campaign for a hotel room, and I'm gonna see for like internet people traveling from Europe or Japan or South America or maybe even Canada. Anybody that had to travel internationally, I'm gonna see if we can get like a place together and if I can finance part of it. So that's the goal. I don't know if I'll be able to do it, but that's what I'm gonna try to.
Well, I hope this has been an interesting interview for your auditors, and we'll certainly prepare something for the future also, huh?
Excellent. You know, the connection's finally fine when we're like being less serious. But yeah, we'll pick it up another time, and thanks for contacting me too. You were the perfect guest I needed on this, someone that worked 25 years with actual political refugees to speak about the situation, because the leftist negative labeling campaign has just been so effective, and it's really sad, but I think it's reaching that boy who cried wolf moment where people go, oh, whatever. And when someone gets labeled as a whatever, you'll say, no, they're not.
So, yeah.
I just hope it doesn't go too far the other way where, you know, the super right wing all of a sudden, who really is racist, to start gaining power too. But we'll see. It's going to be interesting. We've got elections coming up in France. And then we have elections in the U.S. too. So primaries.
Yep.
Real soon.
Yeah.
We have a socialist party.
Well, maybe just maybe one more question after the interview's finished.
Sure.
If you still have a few minutes.
Sure. All right. I'll pick that up. Yeah. Thanks for being with me.